this meeting of the Committee on Public Safety, Finance, and Policy to order. We do have a quorum today. We're going to be hearing four bills today, but before we do that, we need a motion to approve the minutes for February 9th, 2023. Representative Curran, would you like to move the minutes?
So moved.
All right. All those in favor of the minutes from February 9th, 2023, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails and the minutes are approved. The first bill on the calendar for today is one of my bills, so we're going to do a little switch here with Representative or Vice Chair Feist, and I'll make my way up to the testifier table. So the first bill that we will be hearing today is House File 226, Chair Mueller's bill. Chair Mueller, would you like to move your bill?
I will, and the motion is to move it to the Judiciary Committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I see there is an amendment. Your bill is now before us. Would you like to discuss the A2 amendment?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. So this bill is prosecutor-initiated resentencing. The amendment that you have, which is the A2 amendment, does a couple of different things, and we created this amendment based on the feedback from the Minnesota County Attorneys Association. So the County Attorneys Association had requested that we create more of a pilot program for this particular proposal. The bill itself, which I'll get into more detail later, is completely discretionary for county attorneys, so it essentially is a pilot program. However, we recognize that there are county attorneys who were willing to start doing this right away. And so the list you have before you on line 1.4 to 1.12 of the amendment are the county attorney's offices who said they would like to start participating in this right away. So it is essentially like a pilot program for these counties, with then statewide implementation going into effect in 2026. And that way the counties who start doing this earlier upon enactment will be able to provide best practices, advice, feedback to the other county attorneys before it goes statewide in 2026. There are some additional changes on lines 1.15 through 1.19, and that's really some comfort language suggested by the Anoka County Attorney's Office. We think these things were already in the bill, but it just adds a little more clarity around those particular items. And then on lines 1.20 to 1.21, again, that was an Anoka County suggestion, creating this as a preponderance of the evidence test that the court has to use. We liked that change as well. And then that is the gist of the amendment. Thank you.
Thank you. Is there any discussion to the amendment? Seeing no discussion, all those in favor say aye.
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 Those against? Nope. The A2 amendment is adopted. Chair Mueller, please tell us about your bill as amended.
All right. Thank you, Madam Chair. So some of you have heard this before. It was heard, I don't even remember what year, maybe 2020 in committee or 2021. And what it's about is, for some people who were sentenced in the past, their sentences may no longer serve public safety or the interest of justice and actually be a waste of resources. Prosecutor-initiated resentencing establishes a process for which prosecutors can initiate court review of lengthy sentences with participation and input by victims. It's entirely discretionary for the prosecutor. And currently in Minnesota, after somebody has been sentenced and that sentence is appealed, direct appeals, post-conviction, there's no way to later have that sentence changed, even if everyone's in agreement that incarceration for that particular person really no longer serves an interest anymore. And examples of these include such things as elderly prisoners who no longer serve a public safety risk, or people who have gone through treatment and have been rehabilitated and their caseworkers say they've been complying with all the different requirements. Again, victims are given multiple opportunities for input and participation here. And also, it's not just a prosecutor saying, yes, let's do this. This also goes through a court process where the court has to make a determination that there are substantial and compelling reasons to adjust the sentence and must consider the impact on public safety when doing so. It also requires a report back to the legislature, just general information on the case numbers, the demographics, and that would be in the Sentencing Guideline Commission's annual report. And I will note that we anticipate an amendment probably before Judiciary Committee, especially lines 5.3 to 5.7. There's some language there related to sentencing worksheets, and that's not quite the right language. So we're anticipating that we'll be amending that, and we're in discussion with the Guidelines Commission on what that will look like. So that is all I have, and I do have one testifier today, Madam Chair.
Okay, thank you. And the testifier, please state your name and title for the record, and Sherry Cox.
Okay, good morning, Madam Chair and committee. My name is Tammy McConkie. I am an assistant Ramsey County attorney, and I have been a prosecutor in the Ramsey County Attorney's Office for over 28 years. In the last 10 years, I have been the director of one of our divisions that has, on the one hand, a unit of victim witness advocates who serve crime victims and help them through the system, making sure that their rights are realized and that they have resources to support them as they go through it. I also have a unit of attorneys who specialize in sentencing and post-conviction matters, such as expungements. Sure. And so just to talk a little bit about why we are so interested in having this bill passed and would be able to use it. As prosecutors, we're very proud of our role as ministers of justice. And we know that that role does not end with sentencing. We also know that our sense of justice can evolve as we learn more information about situations after they were sentenced. So, for example, something that we now know about youth is that it takes the human brain until people are 25 years old to fully develop. Years ago, when we prosecuted 15-year-olds, their brains were a full decade away from being fully developed. And that was information that we really didn't have at that time and now do. So situations like this, where you have someone who has served a significant amount of their time, has done really meaningful work to rehabilitate, and is no longer served, or the public is no longer served by a long sentence, there's no path for us currently to go ahead and ask the court to change that sentence. And that's what this bill does. It also provides several features to work with victims, to notify victims. I think those are things as prosecutors we would do anyway. Victims are near and dear to our heart. But those are going to be very important conversations as this type of work proceeds, and they're part of this bill.
Thank you so much for your testimony. Are there any members of the public who would like to testify? Seeing none, we can move to discussion of House File 226 as amended. Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Trying to think of how to ask this. So this, as I reviewed this, this struck me as creating a kind of double jeopardy for the victim. And what I mean by that is that when victims go through the process of having a case adjudicated, tried, they go through a kind of trauma, potentially, of having to relive experiences. And they do that and go through that journey so that they can get to the other side of it and get what is often described as closure, and that happens at sentencing. And so now what we're saying is that we're going to open up the possibility that at some undefined point in the future, that wound is going to have to be reopened so that we can reconsider a sentencing that was already ruled upon. That's one concern I have. The second concern is in focusing exclusively on what's being described as a public safety purpose, which I understand, and correct me if I'm wrong, I understand to mean that the person is no longer regarded as being an active danger to society. That's certainly a consideration, no doubt. But the primary purpose, as I see it, of sentencing someone upon a conviction for a crime is punitive. I mean, the administration of justice is meant to figuratively balance the scales. If we're not doing that with our sentencing, then we need to look at our sentencing. You know, if sentences are out of alignment with what justice requires, then we have other processes for dealing that. Given the fact that you have the initial trial, you have the appeals process, you have all these stops along the way to sentencing, and you even have the parole process after the fact that already exists, I'm not quite grasping what the need for this is and why prosecutors would even want to open up a whole nother branch of potential workload to go back and relook at cases that have already been closed out. So if either of you could speak to those concerns, I'd appreciate it.
Chair Miller?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And thanks for the questions, Representative Hudson. I'm trying to take notes because that was a lot. So we can go back if I forget anything here. Just to talk about the victim closure piece for a little bit here, there is a concept of finality in the law, and that's very important. And we have that with direct appeals, and that's recognized. But I will also say that for many victims, having somebody take responsibility for the action against them, often they want to know, why did someone do this to me? They want the person to take responsibility for the action, and they want the person to be rehabilitated and not offend again. And so if you think about some of those things, what this bill is doing is you would go back to the victim with one of these cases and get their input, but also be able to say, like, this is someone who's completed everything we have asked of them, essentially gone through those steps for rehabilitation. And so that is important to many, many victims, knowing that the person has taken those steps and isn't a risk anymore to public safety. And perhaps restitution has been part of that, have been making payments or plans towards restitution. I'll also say that we do have support for the victim advocacy groups. Violence Free Minnesota, Minnesota Coalition Against Sexual Assault, also support this bill. And I think that is probably the reason they would give you two. For many victims, they want to know that somebody is not going to do this to somebody else. For your comments about the punitive part of our system, part of our system is also about rehabilitation. It isn't just punitive. And by creating a system like this, and there are several states that have done this, they have noticed that it's more like a carrot instead of a stick, that it's actually encouraging people to participate in the rehabilitation and other programming, because this is a carrot, it encourages them to do the things and comply because there's a chance this might apply to them. With respect to your comments about the prosecutors and creating a whole other branch of work, this is entirely discretionary. And so some of these cases might be initiated by prosecutors, others they might get a letter from an offender. And I can tell you as a prosecutor, there are some cases where if I got a letter in some of those cases, I'd be like, no. I am certain that this person is not going to qualify. And that's why it's in the counties. It would be up to the counties that prosecuted these cases, because they know the history of this offender, the history of the case. They'd have no responsibility under this bill to do anything other than put that in the recycling bin. It's only those cases where we really think, like I said, some of those situations and the states that are doing this, there haven't been a ton of these cases, because it's a pretty limited set of circumstances. I hope that answers your questions.
Representative Hudson, a quick follow-up. We have a lot of people on the list.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, I appreciate that detail. Because I have to be quick, I'll just skip straight to a quick follow-up, which is there any concern that the discretionary aspect of this could exacerbate some disparities in the criminal justice system?
Yeah, thank you. And that's why we are concerned about that, Representative Hudson. And if you look at line 1.9 to 1.13, that's the sentencing guidelines report. And I added this language into our bill when I was first working on it, because I wanted to make sure that the people benefiting from this aren't also just exacerbating the disparities in our criminal justice system. That's why we have this reporting requirement in the bill.
Thank you.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and first a shout out to Ms. McConkie, who I've had a chance to work with for a long time, and I should say that there's no greater champion of the rights of victims, and I know that from interacting with you through the years. And I guess I wanted to just respond to the point about the purpose of sentencing is always a punitive, or even as primarily, because it's really, there's a variety of purposes, and I see this bill as really being connected to a number of them, because there's a rehabilitative purpose, as Chair Moeller referenced. To a certain extent, there may be a punitive purpose, and I'll note that the line in this handout we have may no longer serve the interest of justice. We may realize that whatever punitive purpose there was, in fact, was adjusted wrongly at the time, and that's the reason prosecutors are asking for that to change. There may be a purpose of incapacitation. That, I think, is a significant purpose, saying, listen, somebody is a threat to the rest of us, and for a period of time, they shouldn't be with the rest of us. That's a part of the process. But again, if it's no longer needed to protect public safety. So I really view this as being supportive of the variety of purposes for which criminal sentences are put, and would challenge that punitiveness is not necessarily the only one, or maybe even the major one, if you consider the variety of purposes for a criminal sentence. So I really appreciate Chair Moeller's work on this. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. And Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First of all, I commend Chair Moeller for remembering all those questions and answering them in details. I think Representative Hudson, you mentioned the piece about the inequities, and I think that was an important piece to mention. I always say accountability has its place in our criminal justice system, but we also know that there are huge disparities in how the sentences are laid out, plea deals that are taken. We know those exist. I see this as a part of the restoration piece, as well as the rehabilitation piece, because what I'm hearing from county attorneys is that they now understand that there needs to be a look back to look at some of the cases, look at some of the sentences that have been handed out, the way they've been charged, to rectify some of the inequities that we have now because of discretion that has been used prior to bills such as this being put in place. And so my question to Representative Moeller, is this in fact a way to take a look at and redress some of those inequities?
Madam Chair.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for the question, Representative Frazier. Yes, it is. And I think a good example where this is applied before is with President Trump signed into law the First Step Act. It made the provisions of the Fair Sentencing Act of 2010 retroactive, so that was looking at the difference between crack cocaine and other regular cocaine and making those retroactive. That's an example of that kind of situation where maybe we had those unequal treatments in those past sentencing, but we're going to take a look back now at some of those cases.
Representative Frazier, any follow-up?
No follow-up, thank you.
Thanks. Representative Beckerpin.
Thank you, Chair Feist. And a couple of things I wanted to touch on, and Representative Frazier sort of brought up one of those, and I think is in the area of plea deals, and especially as we think of the way that this issue might intersect with the work we're doing in the Judiciary Committee around the underfunding of our public defense system. You know, we may have cases where somebody took a deal that had they had a more robust defense, they might have gotten a better deal. And so I think this also speaks to that inequity piece and the ability, sort of recognizing, you know what, looking at this case, looking through the file, with a different attorney under different circumstances, this person may have had an outcome that was different, and sort of recognizing that. So I think that's an important piece of this. And I also wanted to highlight domestic cases. So my experience as a prosecutor was exclusively on domestic violence cases. And as we talk about victims and what they want, you know, victim survivors, and, you know, there may be cases where the deal that was made or the sentence that was executed at the time disrupted that cycle of violence. And this certainly isn't every case, but I can certainly think of examples where the person's been incarcerated, they've done their time, they've done the programming, they've gotten sober, they've done all those things. And the victim survivor, especially if they share children, might actually want that sentence changed for the long-term benefit of their family and everything else. You know, again, that certainly isn't every single case, but I can think of examples where that would have been the case, where the victim was asking me after the fact as a prosecutor, you know, he's going to church, he's doing the programming, he's away from our kids, you know, what can we do? And there really isn't a mechanism. And so I think that this is an important tool, again, not going to apply in every single case, but I think it's a good idea and a step in the right direction to make sure that we're actually doing right by everybody in the system. So I just, no question, just wanted to bring up those two things. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any other questions or comments?
Thank you, Chair Feist. I see the merits of the program in some cases. We talk about the someone that's older, elderly, or maybe gets a terminal illness while they're in custody. And my question to you would be, Chair Moeller, is there, in a case like that, isn't there something where the governor, the director of, or the commissioner of corrections could be involved in commuting a sentence?
Chair Moeller.
So I don't know, and maybe there's somebody here that can answer that. I don't know if my testifier can, but I will say, as far as sentencing itself, we don't have any, there is no mechanism in our system right now, unless a sentence is considered unlawful or illegal, there is no way to get a sentence changed. So if somebody has the right to go seek a pardon or go through that process, I mean, certainly they can try. There are many difficulties with that as well, but there is no mechanism in our law right now with being able to get a sentence changed.
Thank you, Chair Moeller and Chair Feist. One last question. Do you see this as applying to more people that are in custody or people in that are on paper still? I just can't wrap my head around how many people are going to be in this situation that we're going to be adjusting sentences, not knowing what the deal was. You know, if they've been on probation for a long time at under the past sentences, and we're looking at revisionist sentencing, I guess is my question. And you know, how many cases are we looking at?
Chair Moeller.
Thank you. So it would apply to people who are incarcerated or who are on probation. It could apply to either of those situations. In the states that have had this, I don't have the numbers right at my fingertip, but when we started working on it, it really wasn't that frequent. I mean, these are really limited kinds of situations where these cases are being brought. We did request another fiscal note, but I'll say that when we did the fiscal note in whatever year it was, there was no cost because all the assumptions were that it wasn't going to be that many people, and any cost to like the DOC might have like would be offset by any potential person that's getting released.
Thank you. Any follow-up?
No, thank you.
Chair Moeller, any closing comments?
Yeah, thank you. This bill has had bipartisan support in the past, so I hope we can get some support for it again this year. In your packets, you have a letter from the Justice Action Network. That is the nation's largest bipartisan criminal justice organization. And I really thank you for the good discussion and questions today and hope to have your support.
Thank you. Chair Moeller renews her motion that House File 226, as amended, be re-referred to the Committee on Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed?
No.
The motion prevails. Thank you, Vice Chair Feist. The next bill we have on our agenda is House File 1083. That is a Representative Frazier bill, and the motion is that 1083 be re-referred to the Committee on Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law. Is that correct, Representative Frazier?
That is correct, Madam Chair.
All right, and I don't see that you have any amendments.
Not.
So please go ahead and tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Lee Novotny, committee members. Bill 1083 is pretty straightforward. What we know now in this country, we have tons of identity theft issues, and we know the impact that it has on individuals. And we know the impact that it has on individuals for a period of time after they have actually corrected the identity theft. We know that folks can commit crimes in the names of that individual, and we know that that causes a detrimental impact to those individuals as they're moving forward. What this bill would allow in situations where it has been determined that the crime that was charged or if someone was convicted of a charge and it was based on on identity theft or mistaken identity, it would allow for those crimes to be expunged. And if you have the agreement of the prosecutor, you would be able to allow to have those expungements to happen automatically without the individual petitioning for that expungement. The idea of this bill and the intent of this bill is to restore the individual back to the point they were prior to the stealing of their identification. I think the bill is pretty straightforward. I think it is something that makes common sense. The bill has been around for a number of bienniums now. I am looking forward to actually getting this done and giving some relief to folks that have suffered from identity theft or misidentification. And I do have one testifier I know that is listed, and there may be others in the audience, but I will yield for that testifier.
Thank you. And I have on the list Amber Yokeen. So come on down, please, and introduce yourself. Welcome to the committee. And you can introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Amber Yokeen, and I am here to share how this has affected me. So my sister, while in her active addiction, used my name in order not to go to jail. Because of that, my name wound up being connected to a crime committed some time ago that made the news. I had no recollection of this until I went to purchase a firearm for my farm. As you may or may not know, navigating our legal system is daunting. Because the crime was so long ago, it was no longer an electronic file. The clerk couldn't guarantee she could find the file and said she would get back to me. This is when I began doing my own research and found some information through Google. I began cross-referencing information and compiled a case of mistaken identity. After numerous times of driving to the BCA to provide fingerprints and photos, it was found that the crime was in fact committed by her. This is not an unusual thing, and I know several other people that would also benefit from this. That is all. Thank you.
Thanks for sharing that story.
Absolutely.
Appreciate it. Are there any other members of the public who wish to testify on this bill? All right, I'm not seeing any. And before we move to member discussion, I'll just say that I actually had a case once that when I was at the Attorney General's office, we used to prosecute misdemeanors that happened at the state fairgrounds. Mm. That office doesn't do that anymore. And I had somebody who had a charge, came to court, and actually pled guilty using someone else's name. We didn't know that until later and got a call later about the fact that they had actually come to court and pled guilty using that other identity. It was a horrible situation. So thank you for bringing this bill. Member discussion. Representative Novotny.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. And Representative Frazier, thank you for bringing this forward. As you said, it's long overdue. I've got a really funny mistaken identity case I could tell myself involving a brother, but I'll save that for offline. not my brother. Anyway, so the point is, it's a good bill. Let's bring it forward. I think this is going to be the wave of the future with identity theft becoming so prevalent. So I think we need this mechanism in place to get things cleaned up and protect innocent victims. Thank you, Chair.
Oh, Representative Lee.
Thank you, Chair Mueller, and thank you, Representative Frazier, for bringing this bill forward. I have seen it on the streets where an arrest warrant is for a brother or a friend or whatever, and it puts law enforcement and also the person at jeopardy. So, and it could take a while for them to try to figure that piece out. So thank you for sharing your story. I've seen it firsthand, and I think it is a good bill. So thank you for bringing it forward.
Thank you.
Not seeing any other member comments. Closing comments, Representative Frazier.
I think folks have said it all. It is time to get this done. Representative Novotny, I appreciate your words. It's a mechanism that we need, considering the prevalence of identity theft. So looking forward to moving it forward and getting into law.
All right. And with that, Representative Frazier renews the motion that House File 1083 be re-referred to the Committee on Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, the motion prevails.
Thank you.
All right. right. And Representative Frazier, yeah, thanks again, Ms. Yocum, for being here. Appreciate it. Representative Frazier is going to stay there because he has another bill on today's agenda. It's House File 1084, and I believe that your motion is that House File 1084 be re-referred to the Committee on Judiciary, Finance, and Law.
That is correct, Madam Chair.
All right, great. And you don't have an amendment on this bill either, so please go ahead and tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This bill deals with, and Madam Chair, you mentioned it in your prior presentation, this deals with pardon extraordinaries. When someone seeks a pardon, first, there's the pardon board, which we all know consists of the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, the Governor, and the Attorney General. And you need at least two of those individuals to, you need a unanimous decision in order for that pardon to be granted. Now, the purpose of that pardon is to allow for the individual to no longer have to attest to having that conviction or that arrest on their record. The idea is meant to take away some of the collateral issues that individuals have to deal with when they've gone through the criminal justice system. As you all know, when we have a record, it can impact applying for housing, it can impact applying for loans, it can impact applying for social services. So huge impacts on livability for individuals that have a prior conviction on their record. What this bill would do would allow for, if the individual receives the pardon extraordinaire, that they would be allowed to seal that record, but also the courts would then have to notify all agencies that have those records on file and seal them as well. So essentially what it would do is it would seal the records in each jurisdiction that the records are held. Currently, right now, if someone was to receive this pardon, the records remain public. They don't have to say that they have this issue in their background, but the records remain public and they can be retrieved with a search. So this would rectify that, and I think this is also another one that is in a long time coming. So I will yield there. I was unable to secure testifiers for this one. I will have them for the next stop, but I will yield there.
Thank you, Representative Frazier. And I know for those of you who've met Gina Evans before, I know she's talked about her own experience with getting a pardon and then having to go to all these different jurisdictions to try to get these records expunged. So hopefully she or someone like her will be available at the next stop. Do we have any members of the public who wish to testify on this bill? Not seeing any, so we can move on to member discussion. Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this is a entirely sincere inquiry because I do not know the answer to the question. So in a situation like this where somebody receives one of these pardon extraordinaires, if they were to reoffend under the current law, would that existing record be relevant to their sentencing or the adjudication of the case for the follow-up offense, to your knowledge?
Representative Frazier or to nonpartisan staff?
Nonpartisan staff, please. I believe I know the answer, but I'm going to allow nonpartisan staff to chime in.
All right. Mr. Johnson.
Madam Chair, members, a pardon extraordinary does not seal or eliminate the records, but it does return the person to the position they were in before. I'd honestly need to double check the sentencing guidelines to see if it counts as a prior after that, but I'll look into that and get back to you all.
Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And that would really be my only concern with this. I mean, I like the intention of what you're trying to do here, but if it does in fact affect cases with a follow-up offense, I would suggest considering addition of language that would say, in the event that somebody offends, that those records become unsealed for the purpose of adjudicating that case.
Representative.
I think that's a fair inquiry, Representative Hudson. I'll work with nonpartisan staff to get an answer to you, and we'll look at making those modifications as we move forward.
Representative Whitty.
Thanks, Chair Mueller. Representative Frazier, would that also, when it's sealed, does that affect the criminal history when law enforcement looks it up? Is that sealed on that, or would it still be able to be viewed on it?
Representative
nonpartisan staff. I believe nonpartisan staff just said it's not totally sealed, but I will defer again.
I think Mr. Johnson might be looking, but I think there's two questions. One is, what is the impact of the pardon itself, which is not what we're changing here, versus what's the impact of the expungement when somebody has received a pardon?
So, Madam Chair, members, so a pardon is granted, again, by that pardon board. That does not seal or remove that information from any public files. It requires that the court basically put notice that the offense has been pardoned into the court's file. The effect of that is effectively to make it so the person can honestly say that they have received a pardon, that they are no longer considered to be convicted. And that's the language in the pardon statute. An expungement is separate. An expungement, the purpose of that is essentially to remove that from public view. So a pardon itself does not remove that conviction or any other information from public view. An expungement would remove that information from public view and make it so that it's not publicly available either through the court records or through the agency records, law enforcement records, jail records, et cetera. The language in the amendment specifically references a portion of the expungement law, that's 609A.03, subdivision 7A, paragraph B, clause 1. That reference is what permits, under the expungement law, the sharing of expunged evidence among criminal justice partners, law enforcement agencies, prosecutors, and others. Under our current expungement law, that information absolutely can be used for later offenses. If somebody reoffends, the fact that it's been expunged does not mean that it cannot be used in a later conviction. And that's the language that's in this amendment. What I'm not sure on right now is the current status based on a pardon. I believe I know the answer, but I don't want to go out on a limb here without double checking it.
Thank you. That was really helpful. Any other questions, Representative Witte?
That was good.
All right. Representative Becker-Finn.
Thanks, Chair Mohler. It was funny. Both Representative Pinto and I are like trying to look things up here quickly. But one thing I do want to point out that's important is that on line 1.13, it does direct that the records could be, a court could order that the records be reopened for certain purposes, and it does say under that clause that, notwithstanding the issuance of an expungement order, an expunged record may be opened for purposes of a criminal investigation, prosecution, or sentencing upon an ex parte court order. So, I mean, it doesn't sort of clear up how would you know it even exists if it's not in the system to find it. So it doesn't really, I think, clear that up. But there is a mechanism where the court could order that information be available for the purposes of prosecution or sentencing.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I might just wondering about the inclusion of the arrest records. Maybe just something for Representative Frazier just to consider. So I'm trying to think that through. That in general, once an investigation is closed, arrest records are police reports are discoverable or disclosable, I guess, or public. And just thinking about whether, I guess, the court would need to send the information to kind of identify where the arrest occurred relating to this. I don't know if you've thought about that or already thought. And I'm brainstorming on the fly a little bit here, but I just know that kind of jumped out at me, that as opposed to the court records as being, they're a little bit different records. I don't know if you have any thoughts about the inclusion of them in the bill.
Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Pinto. That thought has come up. I've been talking with some advocates and also with the Senate lead, Senator Bobby Jill Champion, about this. And so we may be addressing that in the next step.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Other comments? Representative Novotny.
Thank you, Chair Mohler. Representative Frazier, how many cases are we talking about a year here, and what's the primary crime or charge that people are getting these pardons for?
Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Pinto. I don't have a number for you. I could see if we could get a number. I would imagine these cases, it's not specific cases that I'm thinking about, so it could be broad, but I could see if we can get a number for you to give you an idea of what it would look like on a yearly basis.
Yeah, and I'll just add, too, the number of pardons, the pardon board only meets.
They meet twice a year.
Yeah, they only meet twice a year, and I don't think they grant too many pardons.
They don't.
I don't know the number offhand either. Representative Novotny.
And the follow-up to that would be, is there's been a push from the other side of the aisle to reduce the, right now you need all three people on a pardon board to agree to that, and there's been a push to eliminate one of that, as long as one of the people that are agreeing is the governor, do you see that there'll be more pardons? Is this part of a expanding, or is that not your bill?
Yeah, I'll just know that I. I think we have other bills coming on that issue, so it's not, it's connected in this way, but it's a separate bill regarding the numbers. I don't know if Representative Frazier wants to add anything to that.
Madam Chair, I can honestly say I've got a lot of bills waiting at the reviser, but that is not one of them.
Representative Navani.
Well, just concerned about the rapidly increasing pardons, especially if we eliminate the three-member agreement for a pardon to be granted. So, thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Any closing comments, Representative Frazier?
I think this one is one that's a long time coming. Notwithstanding the concerns that are out there, we'll address many of the issues that were raised. I appreciate those, but they're also looking forward to moving this one forward and getting it done.
Thank you. And with that, Representative Frazier renews his motion that House File 1084 be re-referred to the Committee on Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. The final bill we have on our agenda today is a Representative Holland's bill, House File 1437. And members will be laying over House File 1437, so therefore I'll just move the bill and we'll be moving to lay over House File 1437. Representative Hollins, hi there.
Hi.
Good to see you over there. You had an amendment, but it's my understanding that you will be withdrawing the author's amendment. Is that correct?
That's correct, Madam Chair.
All right. So with no other amendments then, please go ahead and tell us about your bill.
Thank you so much, and thank you, members. So this is my second time presenting this bill, and it's truly an honor to be presenting House File 1437. It's a bill brought forth in collaboration with six statewide anti-violence coalitions. The bill would increase funding for crime victim services, ensuring that victim survivors have access to resources like shelter and housing, food assistance, childcare and transportation, counseling, and legal advocacy to assist them in navigating abusive or violent situations. As a little bit of background, through the Office of Justice Programs within the Department of Public Safety, crime victim service funding is administered by way of a competitive grant process. In fiscal year 2021, these OJP-funded grant victim service programs provided support and services to almost 15,000 abused children, over 55,000 domestic violence victims, over 56,000 victims of general crimes, and just over 8,000 sexual assault victims. Prior to the pandemic, these programs and services had identified an additional financial need of $20 million a year to address the needs of victim survivors and their children, and the gaps in funding experienced by crime victim service programs. Unfortunately, the pandemic has exacerbated this situation, and the need has grown as well as the funding gaps expanded. So we are requesting an additional $25 million per year in base funding for these grants. I have four testifiers here today, and I would like to give up most of my time to them because they are the experts in this area.
Thank you. And the four I have are Guadalupe Lopez, Artika Roller, Marsha Milliken, and Mary Moriarty. You want to make your way. Representative Holland.
I also have Bobby Holtberg on here. Is Bobby not able to make it? Okay.
Oh, she's unavailable.
Okay.
So I don't know what order your testifiers want to go in, but why don't you come on down, and whoever sits there first can be up first. Yeah, and we do note that because Bobby Holtberg couldn't come, she did submit a letter of support, and that is in your packets. Welcome back to the committee, Artika Roller. Nice to see you. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Thank you. Good to see you as well. Chair Mueller and members of the House Public Safety Committee. I'm Artika Roller, the Executive Director of the Minnesota Coalition Against Sexual Assault, also known as MNCASA. Again, I am here with my fellow sister coalition directors, and we thank you for giving us the opportunity to speak to you this morning on an issue that is of critical importance to Minnesotans. We are testifying in the support of House File 1437, which provides a base level increase to crime victim services at the Department of Public Safety. This funding is needed so that survivors can access the services and the supports they need to care for themselves and their families. House File 1437 is supported by each of the six statewide coalitions working to end violence and abuse in our state: Violence Free Minnesota, MNCASA, the Minnesota Alliance on Crime, the Minnesota Children's Alliance, the Sacred Hoops Coalition, and the Minnesota Indian Women's Sexual Assault Coalition. Today, as we testify, our sister coalitions, MUSAC, is organizing a march to bring awareness to the need to end sexual violence. Many of our member programs across the state of Minnesota are also participating in AWARE events as well. Over the past several years, we have heard many discussions about the plight of victims and survivors in our states, sometimes suggesting solutions for victims without discussing those solutions with victims and survivors or the organizations that serve them. We appreciate you hearing from us directly around the needs of some of the most vulnerable people and populations and survivors of violence in our community. Our coalition partners are seeking in House File 1437 an annual $25 million increase to base level funding for crime victim services. Crime victim services funding has not increased in our state in over 8 years. Emergency COVID funding and $5 million in survivor support grants were provided in 2021 to support our programs. Legislators provided a one-time temporary emergency relief. These funds will expend at the end of this fiscal year in June. In addition to one-time funding being depleted, we have learned that crime victim funding from our Federal Victims of Crime Act will be reduced this year by $11 million for the upcoming biennium. So we are facing a critical decrease in fundings that weren't sufficient to address the needs of Minnesota. And now we're at this point where we need an increase in our base level funding. The VOCA funding has accounted for over 60% of funding for crime victim services in our state. A cut in the funding this large without a significant increase from state level will mean that advocacy programs will have to close their doors, and we're already seeing shelters closing their doors in greater Minnesota. Survivors in our state will be left without the program and support they need. Our advocacy programs are reporting record numbers of people reaching out for services. Many of those who seek services are reporting more severe violence, more complex family needs, and an increase in mental health issues. We need a robust, long-term investment in crime victim services in our state, and we need it urgently. Meeting the demands of this moment, our elected officials must invest in community-based advocacy services for victims and survivors of violence. As with every helping sector, ours is facing a dramatic staffing shortfall as well. So many advocates are victims and are survivors themselves. Advocates struggle to gain the financial stability while using their expertise to support people who are in similar situations. And I will turn it over to Marcia.
Thank you. Thanks for your testimony. Welcome to the committee, Marcia Milliken. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Good morning, Chair Moeller and members of the committee. I am Marcia Milliken, and I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Children's Alliance. This work is incredibly difficult, emotional, and critical to public safety. Programs want and should be able to pay advocates the wages they deserve. The demand for victim services has only continued to grow, and programs are struggling to remain adequately staffed to meet the current need and complexity of cases. Programs serving victims of all types of violent crime report they are losing advocates to employers like Walmart and McDonald's that are offering higher wages than our advocacy programs can support. So what do the numbers actually look like? Many smaller programs and those in rural areas have starting wages between $10 and $16 per hour. That's around $19,000 to $27,000 per year after taxes are withheld. Walmart and McDonald's wages start at $18 per hour in these same communities, and our programs simply cannot compete. Although one-time COVID funding was crucial during the past few years, programs are hesitant to offer pay increases that cannot be sustained without consistent funding. Program directors are sharing the following concerns with us. From the Committee Against Domestic Abuse, or CADA, in Mankato, as an agency, CADA currently needs an additional $350,000 annually to pay market-based wages and maintain our current staffing levels. If the 25% VOCA cut were also to happen, we'd have to have an additional $580,000 in revenue annually to maintain our staffing levels. We are on the verge of crisis for our now 9-county area. A rural MnCASA program shared, if our funding is decreased, I would have to let at least one, maybe two staff go, and there will not be enough staff here to meet the needs of victims. Another rural program director stated, our agency used to have pretty fair wages. However, now with the changing economy and the limited funding, we can barely compete with entry-level positions. A rural child advocacy center wants to serve more kids who've experienced abuse, but the center is at capacity and they need more staff to do so. In the case of Hope Coalition in Red Wing, the agency was forced to close their emergency shelter in October due to a lack of staff, and they're still unable to open their shelter due to the inability to pay advocates a living wage. This is a small glimpse of what's to come in communities across our state if we don't provide an increase in base level funding for crime victims. Not only do our existing programs need additional funds to recruit and retain quality staff, there are also too few of these programs to serve the needs of the whole state. Rape crisis centers in Greater Minnesota are often tasked with serving 9 or more counties, encompassing entire regions of the state. Their work can include meeting victims, survivors, at the hospital for a forensic exam at any time of the day or night. Domestic violence shelters don't have enough beds for victim survivors and their families. Child advocacy centers serve kids who've been physically or sexually abused, neglected, trafficked, or have witnessed a violent crime. Although there are over 900 children's advocacy centers in the country, Minnesota only has 13, leaving many child victims, survivors, without access to these trauma-informed services, which include forensic interviews, advocacy with children and families, mental health, and medical services. Advocacy services for victims of crime are difficult and time-consuming and require extensive training. These are services that law enforcement has told us they're unable to provide, both in terms of capacity and skill set. Victim survivors have repeatedly told us they want more options for healing than just a criminal justice response. And I will yield to Guadalupe.
Thanks for your testimony, Guadalupe Lopez. Looks like you're up next. Please introduce yourself, welcome, and begin your testimony.
Bonjour, Chair Moeller and members of the committee. I'm Guadalupe Lopez, Executive Director of Violence Free Minnesota. I'm wanting to talk about the increase of funding for victim services will support victim survivors, access to direct client assistance funds. We need to remove barriers to prevent immediate access to safety and meet the basic needs of survivors. We're hearing from programs across the state that requests for client assistance have increased significantly and have heard that programs have spent funding originally for to hire and increase staff that had to be shifted to direct service of client assistance to meet the increased demand of what their community is needing. Crimes and violent crimes in particular have significant financial impacts on victims and survivors. Direct client assistance funding would help crime victims with the financial losses, increased costs that there are in the result of the violence, like things like replacing doors, windows, things to keep their homes safe, mental and health care costs, assistance with rental deposits or relocation, and a lot more, child care, things that help families stay united and safe. A base level increase of funding of crime victim service will support programs' ability to assist victim survivors with their housing needs. Domestic violence is one of the five key reasons why people in Minnesota are homeless. This particularly is critical for the Black and Indigenous communities and communities of color. In 2001, 24% of Minnesota victims of intimate partner homicide experienced housing instability. As we increase access for financial stability and affordable housing, we increase safety for victim survivors of relationship abuse. We work to prevent domestic violence. An increase of state funding for victim services would allow for increased work for violence prevention. Violence prevention includes safe and affordable housing, pathways to financial stability. We can fund community education and healthy relationship trainings with youth to prevent violence from happening in the first place. Prevention has also included programming to transform abusive behaviors and end the cycle of violence. In order to transform the landscape of Minnesota and to keep all our communities and our relatives safe, we must address and repeat the violence by providing funding for sexual violence prevention, domestic abuse transformation programming, restorative justice, offender accountability programs, and other programs to change abusive behavior. Victim survivors continuously request accountability and services for those who use violence in hopes of changed behavior and that the abuse stops. Not only for them, but for their children. Many of our programs have had to stop providing this programming or are unable to start in the first place because of lack of funding. Victim advocacy programs have a direct and immediate impact on public safety for Minnesotans. We are urging you to support House File 1437 for an ongoing increase in base funding on crime victim services that will sustain and expand these critical public safety operations. The loss of federal dollars coupled with further inaction by our state will mean that programs will close, services will be eliminated, and the cost of these services will fall on law enforcement, substance abuse counselors, child protection agencies, hospitals, and other systems that are already over at capacity. Our services will not be provided at all, and the violence will simply continue. We need your continued commitment to prioritize the safety of our communities and our victim survivors of domestic sexual violence, human trafficking, and all the major crimes, and the communities across Minnesota. Miigwech, and thank you. I would like to pass my time to County Attorney Moriarty.
Thank you for your testimony. Welcome back to the committee, Mary Moriarty. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
I'm Mary Moriarty. I'm the Hennepin County Attorney. Chair Moeller and Public Safety Committee members, thank you for giving me the opportunity to express my support for House File 1437, a bill that would increase funding for crime victim services by $50 million per biennium. As Hennepin County Attorney, I am deeply committed to pursuing justice on behalf of victims of crime and promoting public safety by holding those who commit violence accountable. But justice for victims demands more than arrest and successful prosecution. If we are to disrupt the cycles of violence and abuse, illustrated by the notion that hurt people hurt other people, we must do more to address victims' trauma and provide the necessary services or resources to help them on the path to healing. Otherwise, increased public safety will remain elusive. Over the past several decades, elected officials have passed tough-on-crime legislation that dramatically increased the number of people sent to prison and the time they spend there. But the data shows that increased prison use alone is not a sufficient long-term strategy to reduce violence. While the state has invested substantially in punitive measures, it is time for more funding for direct assistance to victim survivors, culturally responsive programming, prevention programming, and more. Nearly all of the individuals involved in the criminal legal system who I have worked with over the past 30 years have been victims of often unimaginable levels of violence. I have seen up close the difficulties crime survivors live with, and I have seen the legal system sometimes create more harm by leaning on victims to get criminal convictions. Victim survivors want and need more support and options beyond simply pursuing convictions. We cannot ignore these needs and their voices any longer. Today, I ask that we listen to their voices. This bill will provide needed investment in services that will address trauma and help to interrupt dangerous cycles of violence. This is what we need to start creating safer communities. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for your testimony. Are there any other members of the public who wish to testify? Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. Al Flowers. I'm coming on talking about, said this before, the United Black Legislative Agenda. When we talk about victims, I think about people that's getting murdered in my community, that you don't get on the news, yeah, but the families suffer. And so I support what they're saying here with this bill, but I want to talk about the victims in our community that once they die, nobody says anything about them. They don't talk about it, you know, and we talk about accountability on both sides with this violence that's in our community. And it's a big deal when you talk about all these other domestic violence and everything else. We're at the top of the line now. We just in one city in Minneapolis, 500 people shot. That's victims. Those are victims of violence that don't get spoke up on, and so that's what we hear. That's why we are here at this Capitol this year, and we are pushing hard to recognize the African American community. We got different African communities, but this is a specific community that's historically been dehumanized and the things that's happened in our community. So I want this committee to know we are here. We are here to say that we know. I know our people are dying, and I'm speaking for our community right now. I'm not speaking for the county, the city, or I'm speaking for our community. We need the same support. What you're talking about now, I think it should even be higher. If you add what's happening to our community. But if you don't speak on it, then you're never going to hear it. I'll be here to speak on it this whole legislative session. And I got other people that's coming with me. Mickey Frost is over there from the Truth Center. He's been over there at Harding High School where we just watched 2 15- and 16-year-olds. One dead, one's in prison, in jail right now. We there. We're on the front line. And this committee needs to know that we're on the front line fighting for our community, and we want to be heard in this legislative session. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Thank you
for being here today.
Thank you.
Any other members of the public? All right. I'm not seeing any, so we can move on to member discussion. Representative Beckerfin.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. And we talk a lot about almost all of the other people in this system other than the advocates who do this work. When we're talking about the positions that they need to fill, that they're not able to pay people for the work that they're doing, the advocates who do it is the hardest job, I think, emotionally of any job I have worked around or been close to. I always thought that even as difficult as it was to be a domestic violence prosecutor, my job was easy compared to the advocates who are the ones who sit down with these folks and hear these stories firsthand. When someone in crisis walks in the door, they're the one that sits there and listens and holds their hand and does that work. And I just, we rarely talk about those folks doing that work. And so I just wanted to take this opportunity to thank them and, know that we acknowledge the work that you're doing. And I, to that, you know, to the funding piece, it's not just the wage itself, it's the weight of the work. You know, if you could make when I worked at DASC at the Domestic Abuse Service Center, you know, we used to kind of joke like, oh, I mean, I could make $2 more, like making packages look pretty on a shelf compared to like the actual secondary trauma that our folks go through. And so the people who do that work, the people who are committed to the work, they don't do it for the money. And the turnover that we had with our advocates was real, but also completely understandable. It was almost like the the, you know, post-traumatic stress, the things that they were experiencing was very real. And so I think the more that we can do to support them and acknowledge financially, they'll do the work whether we pay them or not. But none of us should feel okay about that. You know, I think it's the same as any of our other, like, care jobs where people are doing that work because their heart is in it. And so, but if it becomes a thing, and a lot of times too, like, we expect them to have 4-year degrees and like social work or some other underlying, and then we're going to pay them less than you get paid at McDonald's to do the hardest work. None of us should be okay with that. So I think this is, I just sent an email to sign on to this bill, Representative Hollins. I think this is really important, and now when we're able to do it, we should be doing this. So I just think the more we could do, the word victims gets brought up almost every single day on the House floor, and this is really the putting the money where our mouths are when it comes to victim services. So thank you for bringing this forward, and thank you to the testifiers for the work that you do.
Thank you. Representative Mueller.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Hollins, for this bill. I do have a couple questions, but I do wanted to acknowledge, Representative Becker-Finn, some of the things that you said. I met just not too long ago with my local people who are working with our victims, and they talked about how they have been there in the last year. They have had over 9,000 services provided. And for a little town of Austin, that's pretty impressive. And they have a staff of 2. So, and they're hoping to get a third. So we know the need is there. I do have a couple questions about the bill, though. So the first one is I don't know what order I want to do these in. The first one is, I really wanted to know how these grants are going to be given out, especially because I know that, you know, I live in Greater Minnesota, and I just want to make sure that Greater Minnesota is going to be represented. And also, as I look, the very last line, 2 lines of the bill of 1.20 and 1.21, it talks about how they have to be. The office shall prioritize those who are staffed by persons of color and that primarily serve communities of color when allocating funds. Now, my community has had a great influx of refugees and immigrants, which has been fantastic for our community. And I talked about that when we were talking about the DL for All bill. And many of our communities have been struggling. The people who are providing the services are not people of color, but are still providing incredible need. So I just wanted to make sure how we are going to prioritize these, how we're going to make sure that Greater Minnesota and places like my small little victim services area is going to be able to continue to get money that they need.
Representative Hollins.
Thank you, Chair Mueller, and thank you, Representative Mueller, for that question. So I think for the technical aspect of how the grants are provided, I'm going to turn that over to testifiers. But I will say that part of the reason why we included, in particular, the language around culture-specific programs and programs that are led and staffed by, you know, persons of color that serve communities of color is because there are cultural differences that we see play out when we are talking to people, especially when they're victims of crimes. If you ask a group of people, have you experienced trauma? Like, the answer will vary wildly depending on what, like, racial and ethnic background they're from, what community they grew up in, et cetera. And so to be able to really provide the services that we need to provide to folks, we have to be able to communicate with them effectively. And so we know that when we have those places staffed with individuals who understand how they communicate and those cultural norms, they're better served and they are going to have better outcomes. But for the specifics of how the grants are determined, I'm going to turn it over to, you know, I was going to say representative, but not representative, sorry.
Director Roller.
Yes, there we go.
Yes. Thank you, Chair Mueller and committee and Representative Hollins. All of our state funding comes through the Office of Justice Programs under the leadership of Executive Director Kate Weeks. And so that's how the grants will be distributed through that process. Grants and oversight is distributed through the Office of Justice Programs. And in addition, for MNCASA ourselves, we have over 66 member programs across the state of Minnesota, and 80% of all of our programs are in outstate Minnesota. And so we are providing services across the state, and even in those very small rural communities, and many of our programs have very small staffs that are working with individuals that represent a diverse community. Yep. Thank you.
Yep, and I'll just note too that they're already doing this grant funding. They already have a whole mechanism in place for doing this. This is increasing to the base, but they already are currently doing this grant funding. Representative Mueller.
Thank you, Chair Mueller, and thank you for your answer on that. We just, you know, when I was talking to several of my advocacy groups as well, when I was talking to my advocacy groups, they were concerned about the reduction in funding from the federal level, but they also talked about just how difficult it is to, you know, there's a lot of competition with OJP, and there's a lot of, you know, OJP is often the place where they have to administer lots of different grants, and so we just want to make sure that it's going to the right places. And again, I just don't see any of that language in this bill, and I understand that it's going through OJP. I just want to make sure that, you know, that on the record at least, that we're talking about how these are going to be distributed and making sure that there is appropriate oversight. And the last thing I'd like to ask about is, you know, we did hear a bill from Representative Frazier, House File 25, about giving money as well, and I think that was about $150 million to these groups as well. How is this? Is this in addition to? Are we no longer doing Representative Frazier's bill? Just wanting to make sure that we have, you know, we have multiple streams of money coming in, that we're taking account of all of that, and making sure we're not getting lost in all of the everything going on here.
Yeah, thank you. And before I turn it over to Holland too, I will say geographic diversity is actually in the bill language on line 1.18 and 1.19. Also, we will be hearing from the Office of Justice Programs when we have DPS budget. And so I don't know if they're here today, but I'm assuming they're listening in. And I think your questions are really good about how are these distributed and making sure they're statewide. And so I'm just flagging that to make sure that we can ask them that question when they come with their budget presentation, because I think it is really important. And then I don't know, Representative Hollins, did you want to add anything?
Thank you, Chair Mueller, and thank you, Representative Mueller. That's going to get tricky. I'm going to mess that up. I'm sorry.
It happens all the time.
Well, you stole my bit about the geographic diversity aspect that I wanted to make sure that we pointed out. But I would also say that because this bill is really specific to these particular to these crime victim survivor grants, whereas I think that, and I correct me if I'm wrong, but as I recall, Representative Frazier's bill was more expansive and diverse in what it would be able to fund, and that it wasn't necessarily directed all specifically to this particular grant program. And so I think what we're trying to do, because, you know, I don't want to say, we don't know what's going to happen, right, as we move forward, but we know that these folks need these funds. Like, we know these victim survivors need these funds. They need these supports. These organizations need these supports. And so we want to make sure that we are getting into the budget with the amount that we think is actually needed. Also, because we recognize that, you know, $25 million per year would eat up a whole lot of what was in Representative Frazier's bill, right? And so I think it's important to recognize that we've identified that this is the need for this particular community and group, and so we want to make sure that that gets in. And what is happening with House File 25 could be in addition to this, but it could also be something completely separate. And if we do actually end up getting the funding for this, I would imagine that that would lighten the load and open it up to, you know, other services being provided by Representative Frazier's bill.
I think think now would be a good time to turn to Representative Frank. Go ahead.
We're talking about him.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Hollins and Representative Mueller. We've had this conversation, and what you are looking for is important. Yeah, that the bill that I have, it's still moving. The intent is still moving. I'm working with the Senate to get things lined up, but it's important. But it is only $150 million, and it is for a limited period of time. It isn't ongoing like this funding, and as Representative Hollins mentioned, that money is dedicated to advocates that are working with victims, where the money in the bill that I have is broader, more folks will have access to it. And I think I mentioned during the presentation that I didn't think it was enough. I want that money to be ongoing. It is not at the moment. So this bill is very important to address some of those issues.
Any follow-up, Representative Mueller? No? Okay. Vice Chair Feist.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I wanted to thank Representative Hollins for bringing in this really important bill. I think it exemplifies a holistic approach to public safety, and as County Attorney Moriarty said so eloquently, I think this is really important because those who are convicted of crimes are very often also victims of crimes, and so thinking about perpetrators and victims as totally separate categories is just not accurate. I do think that prioritizing funding for groups that provide culturally specific programming and are led by people of color is important because disparate access to victim services is a really big part of why we see such dramatic disparities in our criminal legal systems. So I think this is an amazing bill. I think this funding is really important, and I'm excited about it. Thank you. Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess a further thought along the same lines. Which is just focusing on the prioritizing culturally specific programs concept. I guess I was thinking, as Representative Mueller was talking about in her community, there being more refugees and more folks needing support from diverse backgrounds. I guess I view this as encouraging programs to develop programming that is specifically designed for those folks. So, you know, there's that alternative that even if the organization itself is not led or staffed by folks of color and primarily serving communities of color, it's at least encouraging programs to recognize that when programming is meeting people's needs where they are, it's just that much more effective and powerful. So I really appreciate the that alternative at the end of the paragraph of of encouraging programs to prioritize, encouraging us all to make sure the programming is culturally specific and meeting victims where they are. So I appreciate that. Thank you.
Representative Whitty.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. I appreciate you bringing this bill forward, and I appreciate all your testifiers because I've lived it firsthand, going out on a domestic, and it's one of the most violent and one of the most difficult opportunities because sometimes you are separating families, and you need to bring them to a safe place where they can feel secure. My only concern with all this is reading it, how does it would affect like a Lewis shelter out in Eagan where we don't pick who our victims are, and you take them over there. And the part also when we were hearing about domestic violence, we had a DART program, and it was an opportunity for us to follow up. And a lot of times the police officers are the first on the scene, and they're the ones driving them over and have that contact with them. And you want to put them in a safe, secure environment where we can help them because this is life-changing for them because now you're taking away maybe a source of income and all that you know, we can follow up and be that resource to them. So I would really, I understand the intent of trying to, the where this is going, but it's in every community at times. And I think it can be utilized and be an effective tool because your testifiers were very powerful in their message. I can't even duplicate that. But seeing it out there, being able to drop them in safe places where they feel safe for the night and then follow up with them so we can make great cases to help the prosecutors out, I think is very important. So thank you for bringing this forward.
Thank you. And I'll just say, like, don't know what shelter you specifically have. I'm assuming they're probably getting some grant funding already through OJP for those services, and I would hate to see any shelters close because we're underfunding these services and there'd be fewer places to take victim survivors. Go ahead, Representative Whitty.
Yeah, I think it was a Lewis shelter, and I didn't see it on it, but I'm assuming it's one of those that you were talking about, but very like I said, just there's good groups out there that are trying. And when I actually was talked with them, they are looking for funding for a new facility. And even they talked about the staff piece. So I think it's a great thing to help the victims out. Thank you.
Thank you. Further comments? Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I hope for opportunities. I'm glad this is being laid over. I'm glad we're going to have opportunity to consider it further. Hopefully, in the interim between now and then, I can take advantage of some opportunities to get to know some folks and visit some of these operations. Because for me, coming from Wright County, there's an extent to which there's a culture gap where I legitimately don't understand some of the situations that people are dealing with here closer to the Capitol. And there's only one way to solve that, and that's to get to know people, right? But that's part of my hang up with this. As I look at the language, like for instance in 116, other needs of the organization and crime victim survivors, it's pretty open-ended. It's not really defined. There's no reporting requirement in here, and if there was, I don't even know what the criteria would be, what we would be looking to get a report on, because this is, from my perspective, a novel concept that doesn't make it bad. In fact, it might in fact be an opportunity to do stuff like this broader throughout the state. But in order to ascertain that, I need to understand what it is that I'm looking at. I feel kind of like a kid who understands that a car goes, but has no idea how it works inside under the hood. And so that's what I'd like to both understand and then try to fine-tune language so that we make sure that the money actually goes to those core functions so that the gears mesh and people are actually getting their services. So.
Thank you. And also before I turn it, I'm really passionate about this topic, so sorry I keep like interjecting my own commentary here. I don't always do that with bills, because I actually used to be the executive director of the Minnesota Alliance on Crime, so I know a lot about it. I care a lot about these services, and it isn't novel, so there already is money in the base. I think your questions are great, and I appreciate you wanting to learn more about these programs, but it is something that's happening already, and there is really robust reporting. So it's not part of this bill because it's already occurring, mm-hmm. but I think that's a great question. Also, we can ask Kate Weeks about that mm-hmm. when OJP comes for their budget presentation, and I see that Director Lopez came back too, so maybe she had some more thoughts, and bill author, Representative Holland. So I don't know who wants to go first.
Okay, I'll be really quick. Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Hudson. So, again, you stole what I was going to say, that this actually, it isn't too novel, but I understand what you're saying, that you haven't experienced it, you haven't seen how it works. And one of the things I wanted to talk about is I actually did work at a domestic abuse shelter in my hometown, and it does have to be kind of open-ended because you never know what's going to come through the door, and you're never going to know the needs that somebody has. So we would have people come through the door who were literally, they'd just been, they left their home because of an abusive partner, and they have a newborn infant with them that they need to care for. And so all of a sudden, the shelter has to figure out, like, do we need like a breast pump, or do we need like a nursing room, or do we need a bassinet, something like that? Because these people are in crisis, right? And so they just don't have any idea what is going to happen. And so you can't really predict. And so I think to some extent we want it to be a little bit open-ended to make sure that we are accommodating everybody that comes through the door and whatever those needs are. But I will also turn it over to testifiers to give more specific examples. That was just from my life that I remembered.
Thank you, Representative Lopez. Go ahead.
Thank you, and thank you, Representative Hudson. And if you ever want to come and visit, and this is to all of you, please. I want to be your new best friend, okay? We come to Violence Free, come sit at our office. And then we also, like, whenever we have, you are meeting with your constituents. I'm a survivor of domestic violence. I was also an advocate working in a shelter, and then now doing coalition work, and now doing policy work, doing coalition work. So the reporting piece, I'm glad that you're mentioning that Kate Weeks will be discussing that, but as far as being an advocate, you have to to take information, and that is a crucial discussion that we have amongst in the field for the movement of how much information that we do take for reporting and what is important to take, and then how do you do that in a trauma-informed and a good relative kind of way, right? Because some of the information we need and what will be used to cause harm later on or what will come up with those kinds of things, but we do take a lot of data. OJP makes us do lots of different reports as coalition, as grant receivers, documenting who we're helping, documenting our deliverables for the grants or how we wanted to use those funds. So I just wanted to say that as a grantee of one of their programs.
Thank you. And we've talked about this committee touring some correctional facilities in their interim, and I think visiting some of your programs would also be extremely helpful to our members. So look forward to being able to arrange that.
Yes.
Thank you. Representative Novotny.
I'll be brief. Thank you, Chair. Absolutely support these programs. Worked with our local shelter for all of my career, and nothing would help getting a victim that I used to call it lighting a fire under them that needed to get active and put them in touch with the local shelter to get the order for protection and walk them through that, literally hold their hand and walk them into court and make sure they took that first step to get going, do fundraisers, help with our local shelter, and to, as you've said, meet with your local app. You know, I arranged yesterday to meet with our local shelter with Representative Hudson to, get him informed on what they do. I recommend my members vote for this. Addressing some of the conversation about our concerns about line 119 on prioritize. My hang up, and I think several of them are, is that the word recognize, I would say recognize is an important word to use. But here's a bill I really like and really get behind, but then we're seeming to say that, you know, all victims are equal, but some are more equal than others, and that's just the part that I know I'm disappointed in, and I wish, you know, all victims count. I understand the cultural differences. Those are already the federal cuts that I understand are coming across the board. They're going to affect every one of these programs throughout the state, from what I understand. If I'm wrong, please let me know. But like I said, I'm going to recommend a yes vote. I just disappointed in the one word. Thank you.
Thanks. And I don't know that we are laying this over, so maybe this is something that you can discuss too as we think about what our final bill will look like. Representative Holland.
I just wanted to allow allow our testifier to respond, if that's okay.
That's fine. Director Lopez.
Thank you so much. Historically, we have had our, or I think the reason why that language was put in this bill and the way we want to look at that is because historically, communities of color have never, honestly, like today, there is no cultural specific community shelter for our black relatives, specifically only for our black relatives. That is not something that isn't. We have multiple organizations that help all of us. And yes, I hear your concern, and I do want that. And as the executive director of Violence Free Minnesota, I try to work with every single shelter director in order to make sure that they have adequate technical assistance, support, funding, and that is why I'm here in support of our member programs to make sure that everything is as equitable as it can be. But historically, it hasn't been. Our communities of color, indigenous communities, have been left out of a lot of funding and a lot of wording, and so this is where we are at right now to make sure that we get to do that. We are not, this shouldn't be a competition. There's more money to go around than anything, and I think the idea of the lack of is we make that up in our head. I know that there's enough to go around. You all are doing a great job doing all the things that you can do for our communities, and I really, I don't want it to make an either or a pit us against, because that is why our communities are fighting against each other, or certain people don't receive justice. So I just wanted to say that, and Chumigwich for listening.
Thank you. Closing comments, Representative Hollins.
So I would very much appreciate a yes vote on this. I think this is in, well, I guess we're not voting. Huh, never mind. then I'm going to talk some more.
Maybe we should just this before. I don't know. No, we're going to lay this over.
So in addition to my experience working in a domestic abuse shelter, my mother's a social worker who worked with domestic abuse violence victims, specifically in a county attorney's office. And it is so difficult what we ask of crime victims just in general when we are going through our system of justice, how we ask them to relive what they have experienced, to describe it, to get in front of groups of strangers and talk about how they were victimized, whether that's physically or sexually. And it is heartbreaking to see how what we are not able to provide them after that fact, right? We want them to be a part of our solution, and then we basically have no other resources to give them. And so this would really help us be able to provide those additional resources so that we can care and wrap our arms around them and say, what happened to you isn't right, and we're going to help to make it right. So I appreciate the great discussion on this. I'm happy to continue talking about this. It's something I'm really passionate about. So if folks from the other side of the aisle want to talk about it, I've visited Lewis House and I have volunteered there, so I can definitely speak to that as well. But I just appreciate the discussion on this, and thank you. It's a really good bill.
Thank you. And with that, I renew my motion and lay over House File 1437. That concludes today's agenda. We have three bills on the agenda for Thursday, and we are adjourned. Thank you.